Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Nobody really knows why the stock market does anything, but traders voted against tighter credit card regulation today. European debt is never far from the center of attention. And also Robinhood, the economics of trying to live up to a legend. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, working to help small businesses understand what social media can do for them. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 14th of May, everybody, and it's good to have you with us. Cause and effect is a tricky thing to prove when you're talking about the whole stock market. There is only rarely a single reason that the major indices move one way or the other. So today's declines on Wall Street were probably part worries over the European debt crisis, part relief over better-than-expected retail sales, and part just plain political. The Senate is debating a financial reform bill, as you know. Last night, they passed an amendment to limit credit card fees, the fees that get paid when you pay with plastic. The business taking your card pays a fee to the bank that issues the card, and the credit card company, say it's Visa, gets a couple of cents too. They're called interchange fees. They are worth hundreds of millions of dollars to the banks, and they cost businesses a bundle too. Jeff Horwich reports that last night's vote could mean big changes are, yes, they're in the cards.
So you're in the checkout line, and you're offered a choice. Do you want to pay more for your groceries or less? Depends on how you decide to pay. Jeff Leonard with the National Association of Convenience Stores says that could be the future of shopping.
This bill would allow retailers to say, this card cost me more, but this card cost me less. Let's pass on the savings.
In theory, that means debit and credit cards could start competing to charge merchants the lowest fees. The amendment also lets the Federal Reserve decide what a reasonable interchange fee is for debit cards. That could mean the end of sweet deals like this one.
A Citadel debit card earns rewards points that combine with your Citadel Platinum MasterCard points.
Rewards programs on all kinds of plastic could be a casualty. That's what happened when Australia went down this road in 2003. The changes could mean big losses for credit card companies and banks who collect billions from the fees. Shares of Visa and MasterCard plunged on the news. Then again, markets are a little jumpy these days.
The immediate impact is not going to be the dire response that some had feared.
Jarrett Seaberg is a financial services policy analyst with Concept Capital. To him, the notion that 1% or 2% fees will change consumer behavior and reshape the credit and debit economy is far-fetched. The real danger for the banks is if Congress hands the Federal Reserve control to set credit card interchange fees as well. Seems unlikely now, but then again, no one saw the debit card thing coming.
When you're in such an anti-bank environment, everything is on the table.
I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
The CEO of BP has the quote of the day this Friday. Tony Hayward told the British newspaper that the big oil spill is, quote, tiny in relation to a, quote, very big ocean. It has, as you can imagine, gotten a whole lot of play, but with reports that the spill is far larger than earlier estimates, it also goes to illustrate a more relevant point, the enormous public relations hole that BP keeps digging for itself. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
The president himself has called it the BP oil spill, and today Mr. Obama stepped up his public criticism with a blast at the blame shifting during a recent congressional hearing.
The American people could not have been impressed with that display, and I certainly wasn't.
Phil Butler is a marketing consultant at Pamel Visions PR. He says BP's initial willingness to do the right thing has given way to legal language.
BP started a sort of a passive, submissive stance, which is a little bit the way they should have been. Like, we're really sorry, we're doing everything we can. And then they shifted to, it's almost like the company got mad or angry.
That's not playing well with the president or the public, but Brian Dobson of Dobson Communications thinks he understands what's behind it, the tension between BP's image makers and its lawyers. He points to the promise from BP CEO Tony Hayward to pay all legitimate claims. Hayward added that he expects a flood of illegitimate claims because he told an interviewer, "This is America, come on."
That may be something that happens and is likely to happen in any situation, but to say that in the midst of a crisis...
PR expert Phil Butler says the lawyers have their job to do, but right now BP executives should pay attention to their image.
The PR firm is Brunswick Group, which is one of the most powerful PR firms in the world. Somebody there, it would seem to me, would be saying, hey, wait a minute, we need to get away from the bean counters and the attorneys and think about the long term. You can't worry about $1 trillion if you're going to lose $10 trillion.
Butler says a day in court won't matter if no one's buying BP's gas. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Bad news for devotees of a certain television show. NBC is ending Law & Order. The network announced today that the police courtroom drama is going to air its last episode on May 24th. It has been on the air for 20 years now, and some Law & Order spinoffs are going to remain on the air, including a new one based here in Los Angeles called L-O-L-A, Lola, Law & Order, Los Angeles. But for actors back in New York City, today's news is most unwelcome. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Sometimes it seems like you can't walk down the street in certain areas of New York City without coming across a crew filming an episode of Law & Order.
Cut!
The city says the version of the show that's being canceled employs 4,000 New Yorkers. Think actors, grips, costume makers, even the people who feed the crew. Today's news is especially tough on actors like Ivan Quintanilla, who once appeared as a florist in an episode of the show.
What you make in a week or 2 weeks doing a theater job, you can make that in one day. And then on top of that, you add residuals, which is a wonderful thing for actors, and you can end up making a nice chunk of money off one episode.
Just a few lines, he says, can earn an actor enough to pay a month's rent. Quintanilla says that's a paycheck that's hard to come by in the Big Apple.
There are not that many opportunities for television. The Sopranos was huge. Ugly Betty came and went in a year. And Law & Order really is important in employing a lot of actors.
Deborah Dixon is executive director of the Actors Studio, a large nonprofit organization where New York actors often gather between jobs. She says at least a quarter of the group's members have been in Law & Order episodes.
You start counting the number of faces that you see in every single scene and every single shot. It gives you the sense of the magnitude of how many actors that they have kept afloat.
She says NBC's decision to kill off the show will mean unwelcome drama in a lot of actors' lives.
There are going to be more hungry actors on the street. It's going to have a devastating effect.
The city estimates the local economy will take a $79 million hit without the show. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The good people at Ad Age pointed out one possible reason for NBC's decision today. Seems a 30-second commercial on Law & Order this year was going for less than $60,000. Not peanuts by any means, but just about half of what the network was able to charge advertisers just a year ago. Chalk up another triple-digit loss on the Dow, everybody. All that volatility would be boring if it wasn't so worrying. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The oil spill in the Gulf and the financial reform bill being debated in the Senate might not seem to have too much in common at first glance, but there is at least one point of comparison. In both cases, people on opposite sides of the issues are talking past each other. President Obama is blaming the oil companies. Oil companies are blaming each other. Senators want tougher rules for Wall Street. Wall Street says it's just trying to make money. It's like nobody's speaking the same language. Commentator Casey Cole says those barriers can be frustrating, but the separation does help keep us safe.
A friend liked to say that the worst disease afflicting humankind was hardening of the categories, that science and business and art shouldn't be walled off in separate containers because really they're part of a whole. But containers can also mean survival. For lack of a container, a seemingly unstoppable oil spill is spreading like some sci-fi ghoul in the Gulf. The earth sprang a leak, and unless it's contained, we're in trouble. Like a breach in a heart wall that kills you. Containerization is also central to software. It keeps operating systems separate from applications like word processing and spreadsheets. Handoff codes let these containers talk to each other, just as our brains talk to our muscles. But it's a separation of concerns, as computer types call this, that keeps things running. Our financial system was built on separation of concerns, too, until the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, passed after the Depression to separate commercial banks, which hold your money and lend it, investment banks, which take the risks that help your money grow, and insurers, who cover your back if things go south. It's when regulators stop thinking in terms of containers that things ran amok, in the words of Mike Brown, an expert in software and markets both, having been the CFO of Microsoft and chair of NASDAQ. After all, says Mike, our democracy was built on just such a separation of concerns: church and state, Congress and courts, politics and press. Containers have to be porous, of course, so that information or money or blood can flow freely, but you can't bring the wall down completely and not get a mess. That's roughly what happened when my freezer door stood open all night and the ice cubes melted and then later froze into one solid block. Not unlike our economy, except in that case, it seems the door was left open on purpose.
Casey Cole teaches journalism at the University of Southern California. Her most recent book is called Something Incredibly Wonderful Happens. You can tell us what's on your mind. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. A 160-point drop on the Dow is nothing to sneeze at, but given the way the last couple of weeks have unfolded, today's losses on Wall Street are basically more the same. Just because it happens a lot, though, doesn't mean it's a good thing. So here for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we have Andy Brooks from T. Rowe Price, also Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Nice to talk to you, Kai.
Andy, what are we to make of days like today, down 200 points and then the other day up 350 points? The technical word is volatility, but unpack that for us, would you?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think investors have been reacquainted with both risk and volatility. You know, we had such a nice start to the year and sort of every day doing a little bit better, and all of a sudden we've run into a buzzsaw. So we've been reminded that there are just a number of issues out there that are probably going to take a lot longer to solve than we might have hoped. Sovereign debt, the housing markets, unemployment, all those kind of things. And investors have been reminded that it's tricky out there.
So what, Lee? Did investors, like, forget that it was tricky?
Well, they didn't forget that it was tricky, but I think two things happened. Number one, we just were used to this soaring market that we had for a couple months. And number two, okay, so if everybody agreed that things were overvalued, I don't think people thought that the form in which we were going to sort of be told that would be these sort of wild card events, like a trading glitch of all things. Even what's happening in the Eurozone, I mean, that's kind of a wild card too. So I think of all the things that people might have thought could have gone wrong, this really wasn't it. And so that might be really unsettling for a market that was already kind of jittery.
Okay, so Andy, give me some love. What might be a positive sign that we can take out of this?
Well, I guess the positive sign might be that on balance, you know, corporate earnings really have been pretty good. And you can say that the bar was low and these are easy comps and it's going to get harder going forward. But corporate America is doing better and consumer seems to be doing a little bit better. And at the end of the day, we're moving in the right direction. And as I understand it, markets like to know the direction. So if the direction is moving forward and better, then on balance, maybe we can do better. But all the things that Lee identified caused some sense of nervousness among investors.
It's a little scary to hear you say, as I understand it, markets like direction, because this, I mean, you're the guy. You're the market guy that we have on. You're supposed to understand this.
You know, the thing about the market is it surprises you and it does things that you least expect it to do. And, you know, who would have thought we'd worry whether the euro was a strong currency, could potentially be at risk of breaking apart. So those kind of things, those are body blows that take a while to work through.
So, Lee, if things get worse, right, if the investing environment does not get any better and the recovery continues to be really sluggish, does government have, and by that I mean, you know, the Europeans, us, whoever, do we have any silver bullets left to fire? I mean, we've had the TARP, we've had a $1 trillion bailout in Europe, and we're still kind of squishy.
No, I mean, I don't think the government has many more silver bullets. I do think, though, there are silver bullets in what's happening in the U.S. economy. I mean, Andy touched on this, but things are actually going pretty well. I mean, retail numbers were out today, and they were better than anticipated for the third month in a row. Other indicators like manufacturing, production, we are, by all definitions, recovering. Sure, it may not be as strong as it was in past recessions, but we're really coming out of this. It's just that on days like this, people don't pay attention to that.
Andy, what do you think about this statement? The stock market is not the economy, and the economy is not the stock market. Therefore, where the Dow is, you know, it's interesting and all that, but who cares?
That's probably true, but every day it's a scorecard. Every day people think about it. You know, I do think that we are moving in the right direction, and the problem child, if you will, is that this pace and these problems we have are so highly complicated, it's going to take longer to fix than we probably thought it would 3 months ago.
Yeah. Lee, is that pace itself a problem, the fact that things are so slow?
I don't think they're that slow. I mean, I think given what we've been through, this is about as good as can be expected. I think to this point of the economy and the stock market being coupled or decoupled, I think that even if the numbers were better in the fundamentals underlying the economy, there's no guarantee that that would move the stock market one way or the other. It's a day-by-day thing. I mean, it's psychology plays such a role.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, Andy Brooks at T. Rowe Price. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Nice to talk to you, Kai.
Coming up, not getting enough out of Nottingham.
Any other city in the world would give blood to have a hero like Robin Hood.
But first, let's do the numbers. Another volatile day to cap another volatile week on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gave back another 162 points, about 1.5%, ended at 10,620. The NASDAQ sank 47 points, just about 2%, finished at 2,346. The S&P 500 lopped off 21 points, 1.8%. Wrapped up the week at 11:35. Despite today's numbers, though, it was actually the best week for stocks in more than 2 months. Since Monday, the Dow has grown by 2.3%. The NASDAQ piled on 3.6%. The S&P 500 advanced 2.2%. This is not something that TiVo wanted to record. Its biggest loss in a decade, now at 41%. The drop came on news that a federal appeals court is going to reconsider an earlier patent infringement suit against TiVo's rival Dish Network. The announcement sent Dish's stock into Fast Forward up 4% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee holds a hearing titled Gulf Coast Catastrophe, Assessing the Nation's Response to the Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill. The United Nations observes World Telecommunication and Information Society Day, and it's Hemp History Week. Organizers aim to renew support for hemp farming in the United States. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 1 euro could be had for just $1.24 today. That's the lowest the single currency's been in a year and a half. Foreign exchange markets can be squirrely in the best of times. The Greek debt crisis didn't help, and neither did a speech last night by former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker. Volcker said he's not sure that having a single currency for 16 different countries makes sense anymore. To talk about what might or might not happen in Europe and its single currency, we've got Barry Eichengreen on the line. He's a professor of economics and political science at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor, good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Kai.
Well, if Paul Volcker is worried about the euro and whether or not it makes sense to have a single currency over there, should the rest of us be?
Well, there's plenty of reason to worry. Europe has had its Lehman Brothers moment, but it's put a trillion reasons on the table in the last week to believe that they're now serious and ready to go forward.
But what about the underlying premise of that currency itself? They threw it out there 10 or so years ago and said, okay, all you Eurozone economies, catch up and do everything the way that, say, the Germans are doing, because that's the functioning economy in Germany. I mean, is the premise still valid?
The premise is still valid, but the Europeans only ever built half a monetary union. They have excellent banknotes. They have an excellent central bank still, but they haven't put in place the structural reforms and the budgetary rules with teeth that they need to make the monetary union work.
What might those be then? I mean, what could see the Eurozone through this crisis?
First, the individual countries have to do their homework, the Portuguese and the Spanish. And I think they're beginning now. They don't want to turn into Greece. The prime ministers of the two countries have put serious budgetary reforms on the table. Now they need to pass those into law, and they need to do the structural reform to make their economies more flexible to go along with the budgetary reform.
And yet we read this morning in the papers that in those negotiations over that bailout package last weekend, French President Nicolas Sarkozy literally banged his fist on the table and said, I will take France out of the euro if we can't figure this out.
Well, Mr. Sarkozy is emotional, isn't he? You have to remember the context. The context was we need to solidify this monetary union. We need to come to the support of Greece and the other countries that are under pressure now. So he certainly ratcheted up the rhetoric, it would appear. But the point was to emphasize that the European countries need to move forward and complete their monetary union project.
If somebody did try to pull out of the euro, let's say just France, because we've been talking about them, how might that work? I mean, what would happen?
I've always likened it to burning down your own house, that you would precipitate the mother of all financial crises. Countries would be worried about what you would be doing to your own currency once you reintroduced it. Would you be reintroducing it to depreciate it against the euro? That presumably would be the reason to put the drachma back in place.
The Greek currency, right? Yeah.
So to prevent people from running on your banks, you would have to close down your banking system. To prevent people from running on your bond market, you would have to close down your financial markets for a period. And that would not be good for the economy.
It's almost like the guy who holds the gun to his head and says, stop or I'll shoot. I mean, is that sort of what it is?
Pretty much at this point, the guy who holds the bazooka to his head, as people in financial markets have put it. They made a commitment in 1999 when they created the euro that will be very, very hard to reverse.
Barry Eichengreen, he's a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor, thanks so much for your time.
Okay, Kai, thank you.
Russell Crowe is now the latest in a long line of big screen Robin Hoods. He's got the title role in the movie that opens today. The producers, obviously, are hoping for a blockbuster. So, too, is the city of Nottingham, England. Officials there, including the current sheriff of Nottingham, are counting on fans becoming tourists. Those who do visit, though, might find it a bit disappointing. Sherwood Forest really isn't much more than a shadow of its former self. And the city, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard tells us, is sort of depressing.
The clock bell above the Baroque City Hall booms out across Nottingham. It's called Little John, an hourly reminder of the city's links with Robin Hood. Now, says tourism chief Mike Balcombe, Nottingham has a really powerful medium to get that message across.
We've got a multi-million dollar Hollywood blockbuster to get people to come and visit us and bring their tourism dollars and also, of course, future investment.
The city has tried to cash in on the free publicity. May has been designated Robin Hood Month. There are organised walks through Sherwood Forest, archery classes, and many displays of medieval combat.
Finish him off! Finish him!
But the clamour cannot conceal an embarrassing fact. None of the movie was shot anywhere near Nottingham. The city itself has hardly any landmarks linked with the legendary outlaw. Very exasperating for tour guide Margaret Harrison.
It is a problem. We are selling Nottingham because of the movie. We have nothing to show that represents anything to do with Robin Hood, to do with the movie.
The dark underground caves you're about to enter were not created by nature.
Nottingham does have some great tourist attractions. These caves are well worth a visit. But they're not connected with Robin Hood. Neither is Nottingham Castle. In fact, it's not a castle, but a mansion built long after Robin's day. There was a rather tacky Robin Hood theme park in the city. It went bust earlier this year. Margaret Harrison says the city has never known how to celebrate its most famous son.
Any other city in the world would give blood to have a hero like Robin Hood. And the one city that goes, oh, him again, is us.
But some of the citizens are trying. This is Adrian Edwards in medieval costume, equipped with hunting horn, a bow, a quiver full of arrows, and a sword. He hires himself out for public and private functions as the city's official Robin Hood.
I was always aware that there was a gap in the market and things that the city council should have been doing. And so the ethos of Robin Hood lives on within me and my work.
But here in City Hall, galvanised by the new movie, the council is trying to mend its ways.
We realised that Robin was way underutilised, so it was let's bring Robin back and do something really big for this city.
Leon Unksor was the Sheriff of Nottingham for the past year. Ironically, holding the office of Robin's ancient foe, Leon has been casting around for ways to honour and exploit the legendary outlaw. He wants to set up a major Robin-related tourist attraction in the city.
Robin Hood is a fantastic story to sell. It has the adventure, the romance, good over evil. We need something really ambitious for this city, and within 6 years we should deliver it.
But tour guide Margaret Harrison says she's heard it all before. In fact, 20 years ago, after the last major Robin Hood movie, but it came to nothing.
I think you've got to think positive. And yes, of course, we will have a great big major attraction. What year are we on? Let's look at 3047 and we'll get it.
She consoles herself. Her hero's main activity is still flourishing here, though not as a tourist attraction. It's robbing the rich to pay the poor. Today, Nottingham is home to the national headquarters of Britain's Income Tax Office. In Nottingham, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a quick example of the government actually saving money. The Obama administration set up a website, recovery.gov, to let the public track spending from the economic stimulus package. On the theory that every nickel counts, government computers aren't going to host that website anymore, letting Amazon.com do it. It's going to save $750,000. Don't know if that's going to show up on the website, though. And that is Marketplace this Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow off 162 points, 1.5%. The Nasdaq down 67 points, nearly 2%. The S&P 500 off 21 points, 1.8%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Ewell. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, personal finance lessons for everybody from L.A.'s Skid Row.
I tell them all the time, look, if you save $5, you did more than you did yesterday. Try it.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.